Hi, this is Helen, and thank you for joining me for a cup of teal. Teal is shorthand for the future of work. It means bringing your whole self to work, a focus on purpose and self-management. And this podcast is a chat over a cup of tea with the people who are making this happen in health, care, and public services. Stories of self-management in action. What is it like to be a coach in a self-managed team? Now, we know that Birdsalk is legendary. It inspired our work in wellbeing teams and is now reaching beyond the Netherlands. Peter is a coach and is a program lead for a two-team pilot working directly with Birdsalk in a European-funded project. This is taking place in the NHS Community Trust in Kent with the purpose of redesigning community care. They want to build community that supports itself and promotes good health, bringing together medical care, social care, community and housing. Peter talks about the development of team agreements and covering the detail of what happens if somebody can't get to work, annual leave and rota arrangements. He talks about how in his role as a coach, he helps resolve issues and supports the team to come to decisions and explains how they recruited their first team of two nurses and two social care trained people. So what's it like to be a coach? How do they do performance management and their equivalent to that? And what's the minimum viable assurance that keeps patients safe and respects the training of staff? So if you're curious about what team meetings look like in a Birdsalk type team and what their alternative is to supervision, please get your cup of tea ready and listen to Peter.
Hello, yeah, my name is Peter Brock. I work for the NHS. I work for the Community Trust in Kent. Yeah, we're very fortunate to be actually working with Birdsalk in the Netherlands about and thinking about how we redesign community care.
That sounds wonderful. And what's exciting about the way that you're working is you've gone beyond just working with nurses. So could you tell people about how you're setting the teams up and who's in the team and what you're hoping to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. So as an organisation, one of our strap lines is that we want to build a community that supports itself and promotes good health. So that obviously includes ourselves in that community, but it includes, you know, patients and other stakeholders as well. We know from what we've done previously and from lots of research that it's not just the presenting medical issue that is important in people's lives. And we know that by offering care in a holistic way, by paying regard to how people are living and, you know, their housing situation, their social isolation, that we actually get much better health outcomes. I know it sounds really strange, but people get better quicker if they're engaged in their community and also their housing situation.
Wonderful. So you're bringing all of that together within the scope of teams. So how big are the teams and who are part of the teams?
We think a team needs to be 8 whole-time equivalents and a maximum of 12 individuals. A few reasons for that. One is that we want teams to be local. We want people to not be in their cars, not be on public transport. We want people as far as possible to be seeing patients or equally having time with each other, because it's really important for people in our teams to feel supported and valued and part of a community themselves and their team. So their team needs to be a community. In terms of the range of roles in the teams, we go from what we call band 3, which is like a healthcare assistant type role, all the way through to a band 7, which would be typically a nurse with a master's qualification. Those bandings and those skills reflect how teams are configured in the Netherlands. And when Birdsalk was setting out their philosophy and their team design, what they wanted to do was have a general team with all these bandings of skills from 3 to 7. Because they felt that you would be able to manage 96% of all cases that you're going to come across if you've got those bandings. You know, for particular care specialisms like end of life or dietetics or podiatry, you might need to bring a specialist in. But for most general issues in the community, the team should be able to handle it.
Thank you. And for the band 3 people who are delivering very personal care, put people to get up in the morning, medication, get dressed, etc. How many people at Band 3 are in each team?
So this is our philosophy, so it might be different to others, but although we've got those bandings, we would expect a Band 7 to do social care tasks as much as we would expect a Band 3, 4 to do those social care tasks. What's more important for us is that the people in the team can build a rapport with their patient. Mm-hmm. So if their patient needs help getting dressed or help with toileting or help with showering, and the Band 7 nurse happens to be the person who's seeing that client, then the Band 7 nurse will do it. This may be controversial, but I think we've got too hung up on all of this banding. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you know, a senior nurse has got a lot more clinical skill, but they gain a huge amount from doing the whole range of care. So it's a very intimate thing to help someone wash or help someone get dressed. And the nurse can see things. They can see if the patient's got a bruise or if there's an abrasion or a wound. And they can ask questions of the patient of, you know, how does that feel? Does that cause you pain? There's an awful lot of information that they can pick up in that process, which if we were to say, oh, only a Band 3 or Band 4 can do that task, then we just wouldn't have that information and we wouldn't be giving the quality of care that we want to give.
You're right. It is controversial and flies in the face of what a lot of people believe about efficiency. But I think that's also what's wonderful about the Wurzburg approach, is this completely different way of thinking about how we bring together skills and contributions in a different way. Some people wonder whether you can truly have a self-managed system with that. Does there any natural gravitation towards people with greater qualifications or a higher banding to take more authority in a team?
So one of the things I'm doing at the moment is I'm supporting our teams as a coach. I'm not a line manager, I make that very clear, but I help the team to make decisions. Mm-hmm. And through the process of the team meeting and the training we give the team, we reinforce the fact that you might have a particular skill in one area that is greater than another person, but it doesn't give you more of a voice. Mm-hmm. We very much want people to be making decisions as a team. So it's not a democracy, it's a consensus. So the team write an agreement themselves about how they'll cover if someone's off sick, how they'll cover if someone's car breaks down, what arrangements there should be for annual leave, how the rota will be, who's going to do Christmas, who's going to do New Year, who's going to do a bank holiday. All these things that the team decide themselves without any management intervention. Where I come in as the coach is, of course, these issues can raise conflict. And so as the coach, it's my job to ask questions of the team, not to solve their conflict, but just to help them resolve issues, help them come to decisions. The people we've got on the teams, they're all very patient-focused. And through that, that really motivates people to be, I was going to say, self-sacrificing, but I don't think they are being self-sacrificing. But they buy into the vision, they buy into the ethos, and so it doesn't feel like a huge burden. Mm-hmm. It feels like they're doing something for their colleague who they like. They're doing something for their colleague who they trust, and vice versa. If someone's doing something for them, I think having that community ethos in the team is absolutely critical. Mm-hmm. Because if you start to have divisions in the team, that's when things can really go wrong.
How did you find people to do this? Because self-management might not be for everybody. So could you talk me through the process of finding people who then became part of the first team? And I understand you've just recruited your second team as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This kind of work is not for everyone. This philosophy is very different to the prevalent culture we've got in the UK in terms of work culture. Mm-hmm. So to recruit our first team, we had a number of engagement days with a number of stakeholders. They were open to the public as well. We talked about what we wanted to do. We talked about our aspiration. We had people from Wurzburg come over, which was very helpful to talk about their experience. And then we just sought volunteers, is the honest way of putting it. And we started our first team with two nurses and two social care trained people. And that team have had you know, a lot of support from Birdsong themselves. It's one of those things. My previous career was in digital, and again, that's kind of quite similar to this in that there's an objective in that you're trying to deliver something useful for a customer, and kind of how you get to that objective collectively as a group means that everyone has to use all their skills. They have to bring their whole self to work. Mm-hmm. So that's again why I think we've got a bit hung up on the bandings in the NHS and in social care, and I don't think that relevant. So you might have a band three who's a scout leader, or I don't know, who's a church leader, or is a leader at a mosque, or where, whatever it might be. They've got lots and lots of skills that they can bring to work, but if they're a band three in the traditional sense, they might not be able to share all those skills and share all that experience. And we want to tap into all that. We want to release all that. We want to make all that available. You know, that makes much happier people at work, which is another critical thing we're doing this for, because we want people to be happier at work and more satisfied with their jobs. It's better for patients and for clients. You know, the more happy our staff are, the better that interaction is, the better the care is. It's a sort of virtuous circle, really.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in terms of bringing your whole self to work, I know that in Birdsong, roles are shared. What are the roles that you're using with your current teams?
So again, very much on a voluntary basis, we share out the roles that you might typically think would a line manager would do. So we have a person who takes on the role of a planner. So that person looks after the rota. In fact, we have two people who do that together in our current team. We have another person who looks after the budget. In Birdsong terms, that's the reporter. We have a person that looks at the team performance. And we have what's called a team housekeeper. And that's the person that makes sure the office is, you know, the office is good. There's materials and there's things that people need to do their work. But having said that, these roles are taken on by individuals, they're discussed in team meetings. So the idea is that obviously, if you do this role, you're not just left to do it. You can ask for help. And as coach, I can also add some support. In our setup, we have what we call a heat shield, mm-hmm. because we are a traditional NHS organisation. And so from the centre of our organisation, we have lots of bureaucracy and demands that are coming onto the team. And so we've got this person in the heat shield role who's effectively acting as an umbrella to try and keep all that away from the team. And if anything does need to be done, they do it on behalf of the team as far as possible, so the team are not distracted from their care.
That sounds incredibly helpful. And in your role as a coach, is that your full-time role?
I wish it was. No. So what happened is that when we started our team in the autumn, we'd gone out to recruit for a coach and couldn't attract one at that time. I've done coaching previously in a different context, so I volunteered to be the team coach. But my role is actually more of a program lead role. So it's my role to look at this from an organisation perspective, and to see what lessons can we learn from these teams. So we've got funding for two pilot teams. We're about to start our second team. And it's what learning we can take from these teams and put into other areas. So we're already looking at other areas of our work as a community trust, not just community nursing, that could work in a much more of a devolved way. So the authority rests much closer to patients. Because we're already convinced that better care is being delivered because the people that know the patients are being empowered to make the decisions. There's not a long sort of chain of decisions that need to be made.
Could you explain about the day-to-day experience of being a coach? So, for example, would you, as a matter of course, attend team meetings, or do you just get called in if people think they need some help?
Yeah, so for new teams, it's more intense. So the teams need to be inducted. As I said, this is a very different way of working. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time with our first team explaining what the Birdsong model was, what our aspirations were as a trust, listening to the people in the team as well about what their previous experience was, what skills they could offer. And we worked together to draw up a framework. And what that framework is essentially is a a quasi-contract between my organisation as the host organisation and the team. And it sets out quite clearly what we want the philosophy of the team to be in terms of, you know, putting patient care first, having fun at work second, and then thirdly, staying in budget. So it's a relatively simple document. It's in plain English. It's obviously got things in there like complying with the law and doing no harm and all those kinds of things you'd expect from an NH organisation. And as a coach, that's been really interesting, helping develop that document. And then I suppose, I don't like this using this word, but I suppose monitoring that document and holding the team to account against that document and holding the organisation to account against the document as well. So where the organisation might say, oh, we want you to do this, it's being able to go back to the organisation and say, well, actually, it's not in the framework. And if the team are performing well, let's just leave the team alone.
It would be great to explore a bit more about what everybody else calls performance management, how you make sure that the team is doing and delivering what's expected in relation to the framework. So the role has a coach of both supporting the team to make decisions and holding them to account. What's that look like in practice?
Yeah, I've been really fortunate to have spent quite a bit of time with Jos de Blok talking about this very issue. And he's a very interesting chap. Mm. He was a community nurse himself. He worked as the innovation director for a nursing organisation. And he basically got so frustrated with all of the innovations and all of the things that were coming in. And in his view, they were actually leading to worse care and not better care. And that's why he set up Bertsov. But one of the things he talks about is the intrinsic motivation of nurses. And what he means by that is that through their training and through their national registration, nurses have a particular way of acting when it comes to solving problems, and they have a particular way of acting ethically. So in terms of quality management, performance management, what we're trying to do is to support the existing intrinsic motivation. And what we're trying to do is to take away anything that gets in the way of that. You know, I work in the NHS. I like the NHS, but there's a huge amount of over-assurance. And a lot of this pilot work is about what is the minimum viable assurance. What I mean by that is, what is the minimum assurance we can put in that keeps patients safe, that means care is delivered really well, but also that really respects the judgment of incredibly well-trained staff. So how do we respect their training and empower them to make the decisions they've been trained to make? And a lot of the things we do in the NHS, unfortunately, for good reasons, we're trying to assure things and trying to keep, you know, make sure the quality is good. But actually what we're doing is we're layering on bureaucracy and we're kind of undermining the ability of people to make good decisions. Again, another controversial point.
That's not controversial at all with me, but I know that would be for some people. Is the natural extension of that then? Do you believe that you can have the same model and approach with people who don't have the same kind of professional background and training as the nurses and social care colleagues that you're talking about?
So again, this is probably where I'm going to go off piste from the NHS director of travel, because the NHS likes to talk about multidisciplinary teams. Mm-hmm. I can see the benefits of that, but I, in terms of a self-managed team and an effective self-managed team, I think it's much better to have teams of specialists who are alike. So my view is better to have a self-managed OT team or a specialised health visiting team or a specialised podiatry team, whatever it might be. And then they work with a generalist self-managed team. My view is that in the community, you have lots of self-managed teams. And I like to think of them as like beehives, effectively. You've got bees that have different roles, just like in a bird-song team. Mm-hmm. But a bee knows how to be a bee, just as a carer knows how to be a carer, and a nurse knows how to be a nurse. I just think in terms of language, attitude, approach, it's much easier, actually, to have self-managed teams of different specialisms. So GPs talk a different language to nurses, and nurses talk a different language to OTs. Yeah, it might be a personal view, but I just think it's more efficient.
Thank you. That's a really interesting view. And as you say, is at odds with the sort of integration agenda, both with health and social care and multidisciplinary teams. So I'll be curious to see what we continue to learn about that in practice. I think when people ask me about wellbeing teams and what does self-management look like, I often talk about how the meetings run and that being a good example of the difference between self-management and ways of working. Is there anything that feels particularly different or remarkable about the meetings that your teams have?
Oh, yeah. Totally different to traditional team meetings. So first of all, the agenda is agreed by the team members, so there's no external agenda. We suggest things to go in their agenda. So we suggest, obviously, client quality goes in their agenda, and ROTA and things like that go in their agenda, and continuous professional development. But ultimately, it's for team members to decide what goes in the agenda. What we'd expect is that the people would be suggesting things this week for the agenda on Monday. And then if the meeting happened on Monday, it would go very much along these lines, that the chairperson, who the team appoint, the first thing they'd say is, has anyone got any announcements? And that's a really good way for anyone in the team to share quick announcements, maybe about a patient or an upcoming visit, or could be anything. But it's a really good opportunity at the start of the meeting while everyone's focused to share that information. And then we ask for any other business. The reason for that is because quite often any other business comes at the end of the meeting when everyone's, you know, got half a foot out of the door. Mm. But actually, there could be some really important things being raised in that any other business. So the chair will note if anyone's got any other business, and they'll ask if it's, you know, for information or for discussion or for decision. And then team meetings normally last 90 minutes. If it looks like the agenda is going to run on more than 90 minutes, collectively as a group, they say, okay, is there anything we can save to our next team meeting? The other thing that I would say is very, very different and that we've learned direct from Birdsong is things are solution focused. By that, I mean, it's not a moan. So it's not someone saying, oh, this has happened and this has happened and that's happened and isn't it awful, isn't it a disaster? Obviously, it's important for people to be able to offload and to share things like that, but that doesn't tend to happen in the team meeting. The team meeting is much more focused on whatever the item might be, what's the goal of this item, has anyone got a solution? So the person bringing the item doesn't have to have a solution. Is that a viable solution? If it is, how are we going to work towards it? How are we going to communicate that solution to others? When do we need to have that solution in place by? And so, well, one of the key things is what the position is. Mm-hmm. So are the team in position to make a decision and make that solution, or do they need to go to someone else? Do they need to ask the coach? Do they need to ask the heat shield? Do they need to go to someone outside the team? So it's a much different way of working. And one of the things a lot of people think, oh, self-managed teams, that's no management. Actually, it takes huge rigor and huge discipline to work in this way. I still think the rewards are worth it, but it does take a lot of mental energy to work in this way.
I agree. And what training and support do you give the team to enable them to fully embrace self-management?
Okay, so the team we've got up and running, they've had probably about 4 days training so far already on team roles, self-management. The method I've just described is called solution-driven method of interaction. Well, they're due for another 2 days training. I'd say over a year for a new team, they probably need at least a week to 6 days of training about this method. The thing I would say about self-managed teams, and I'm sure you've had this experience yourself, Helen, is that you need to allow the team to try things out for themselves. A little bit like the, you know, the PDSA cycle. You want people to plan things and for them to try things and for them to study what happened and learn from that. So I feel you could smother teams if you give them too much too soon. In my view, they need to sort of bed in, need to build relationships, need to try things. As long as a coach, I'm reinforcing that reflective practitioner. You know, this is how we want you to behave, and we don't want you to be upset if things don't work quite well. Yeah, that's the approach. I mean, obviously, for patient care, we have protocols, which are national protocols, which all nurses follow. So I'm not talking about trying to innovate any protocols like that, but I'm talking about the way they work, the way they organise their time. Yeah, those kinds of things.
And one of the questions that's often asked about self-managing teams is what happens instead of supervision. So, you know, traditionally in adult social care, certainly you might be expecting to have a one-to-one supervision session with your line manager every 6 weeks. How does that look in your team?
Yeah, so it is very different. We have a two tops approach. So what happens on that sort of cycle, six-week cycle, is a team member will meet with two of their colleagues, and the colleagues will effectively act as the line manager, I suppose, or the proxy line manager, and they'll say, we noticed these two things which were really good, and we noticed these two things which maybe you might want to think about. But it's, having said that, because of the relationships in the self-managed team, the kind of appraisal and supervision is happening all the time. Mm-hmm. So we do that because it's important for people's development to know it's being recorded. And obviously for the end of the year, we need to do certain things as an organisation to make sure people get paid what they should get paid. But as for the team themselves, we try to keep that as light as possible. And what we want to encourage, obviously, is any member of the team is empowered at any time to speak out if they have any concerns about patient safety or patient quality or safeguarding or anything like that. That's all made clear. To answer your specific question, we do have the two tops, two tips method, but I think that's less important than the honest, respectful challenge that is inherent in the team.
Thank you. And one of the areas that we've been grappling with is around whether you call it productivity or what percentage of time is directly spent with people or patients. Now, I understand that with Birdsong it's about 60%. What's that like for your teams?
Yeah, so it is a challenge. I'll tell you what the biggest challenge is getting NHS systems to put the data out in a meaningful format that means you can give the team an accurate report. So firstly, I'd say that going back to this point about intrinsic motivation, I think it's really important that team members know how they're doing as a team. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that they have a report which does show their performance. So things about productivity, if there's any serious incidents against them, the classification of those serious incidents, things like annual leave, like a team compass, like a true north, where are we as a team? It doesn't need to be complicated. But one sheet of A4, that's critical, and we're working really hard to get that report. We're not quite there. In terms of productivity as well, I suppose, again, speaking to Jos de Blok, what he has said to us is that we shouldn't expect too much too soon. So obviously when Birdsong start a new team, a lot of the people joining that team are already familiar with the Birdsong approach, and so they get from a position of 0 to 60 in between 3 and 6 months for new teams. For our first team, we've not actually said to them, you've got to get to this point by this date. We've just worked with them and they are increasing their productivity. For our second team, we're going to be slightly more directive, if I'm honest. But again, that's not the most critical thing at this point, because we're very fortunate we're in this position where we've got some research funding from the European Union to see if the Birdsong model will work in the UK context. And within the confines of, you know, the registration and regulation envelope that we have in the UK. So because of that, we're able to be more considered about applying that productivity target.
Thank you. So that leads really nicely to my final question, which is about the future. And you said this is part of a research project. So what's going to happen next? When does this end? And what are you hoping will be the next steps around that?
Well, this project actually runs to October 2021. We are about to start a second team, but this project doesn't exist in a vacuum. And what I mean by that is the NHS 10-year plan and the advent of PCNs, primary care networks, is happening. It's happening right now. And so I think as an organisation, we're going to be doing a lot of engagement with PCNs about how community nursing can better support PCNs. and better integrate. So as I said before, my view is that that multidisciplinary teams are not necessarily the way forward. So if that isn't the way forward, then how do we get our generalist team to support the community pharmacist and the, I can't remember the name of the role, the social prescriber in the PCN? And so our traditional community nursing teams are much larger than these teams. They cover a much wider geographical area. But it seems to me the direction of travel with PCNs is much more about local. I might be wrong, but the agenda I see it is to eventually move to PCN cohorts of 10,000 patients. So if that is the case, then how do we configure community nursing and community care teams around those similar cohorts? You know, what skills do we need? How big do the teams need to be? What's the care provision look like? Is it 24 hours? These are huge questions that we're wrestling with. But I'm really excited because I actually think that self-managed teams and things like Birdsong and wellbeing teams, where we're looking at patients holistically, is exactly what the NHS 10-year plan and the PCNs are trying to achieve. So I think we're slightly ahead of the game. So my work over these next few months is going to be to engage as much as I can with the developing PCNs. And yeah, maybe, who knows, but maybe we'll have many more community nursing teams and health visiting teams and other specialist teams who are working along these lines as self-managed with a framework, you know, a quasi-contract. And as long as they meet the targets in that quasi-contract, we just get out of the way. So as an organisation, we become much more of a facilitator, a provider of assurance, provider of training. But in terms of being like directive line management, we're that's not our role anymore.
Peter, that's a fantastic place to finish. I'd love to keep catching up with you and seeing what you're trying and learning and perhaps sharing a bit about what we're trying and learning too. But that's been a wonderful insight. Thank you so much for spending the time sharing. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you for listening. I'd love to hear your reflections. Please tweet me. I'm at Helen@WBTeams. This podcast is a companion to Open Teams. On this podcast, we share the voices and stories of pioneering organisations in health, care and public services. And on Open Teams, you can see the documents that they're using. Have a look at openteams.co.uk. And if you're interested in wellbeing teams, please come and find me on LinkedIn, where I share a weekly two-minute film, or my blog site, helensanderson.net. And finally, if you're interested in self-management and need some support along the way, I'd love to hear from you. I'm at helen@wellbeingteams.org. Thank you.